From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Groundsman. Joining me, leaning on our rakes this morning, as always, first up in London, presumably, the great Giles Morgan. Come in, Captain.
Hey, Grant, how are you? I've bought a new rake. And
you've
I feel
a new
I'm,
rake?
A newer rake. It's broader. It's got a broader, I don't know, it's called a brush, but it's got a broader sort of piece, and I'm picking up all sorts now.
Now, this reminds me of the great Only Fools and Horses joke with Trigger when he gets awarded the Council's Medal of Service because he's had the same rake for 30 years.
Exactly.
Go, same rake for 30 years. Yeah. 15 new handles, 17 new heads.
Exactly. Well, my one is brand spanking new. I got it from a DIY shop and I'm really, really looking forward to this episode.
Nicely done. Well, the third man leaning on... A far more fashionable and stylish Italian yeah. rake is our man
automated
in the lake, by the lake, Roger Mitchell. Roger.
Hi, Grant. How are you?
Very well indeed, my friend. Very well indeed.
Nice to hear the captain. And it's great that he still talks to us after the kind of people he's hanging about with.
I know, right? Talk about rubbing shoulders with the stars. Jeez.
Unbelievable. Talk about raising the bar.
I've got a bit... Well, yeah, but I've got to be honest with you, it's much more fun with you guys. Some of them, it's so highfalutin. And spending time with these people on board for that much time is it's exhausting, to be honest.
But just do us a favour. Can you please just let Gary Player know, just knock it off with the autograph request? It's just getting embarrassing now. I've told him once. I've told him 100 times. I don't do those.
He keeps asking. Giles, I've been asked by a couple of people, can you physically describe the steward, Paul?
I can. He's sort of got dark curly hair. He's quite swarthy looking. He's got a very gammy leg. Very gammy leg. And he spills drinks. Brown eyes. Bit scruffy. Yeah, that's it. I mean, he's a nondescript, but he's been close
Sounds
to getting
like
fired.
Sounds like Sunil Gavaskar.
No, he's taller than Gavaskar. And Gavaskar would not drop a drink. He was too sharp. He could,
that's true.
Could be anywhere.
He dropped a few catches.
No, not many.
Not many, no. Fair enough.
No.
Well, gentlemen, I mean, look, lots to discuss in the world of sport. Despite the lockdown, it seems to be changing rapidly, whichever way you look at it. Roger, as always, I'm going to come to you first because you are a man with his finger on the pulse. What's the first subject for discussion this morning?
Well, you know, I like to have a macro, then a couple of micros underneath. I'll start with the macro. I think budget controls, financial fair play.
Well, how did I guess this might be on your radar?
Yeah, so we can start either with Formula One and link into Ferrari, which being in Italy is a big story here, or we can do what I think everybody else has and see if we can get a different angle on the Man City UEFA and what it means for football as an investable asset, because I actually think that's what the real story is. We've said on The Groundsman many times that many of the Americans coming into football now, including Jerry Cardinale in Europe, is because of financial fair play. It's because there's a system in place that almost guarantees profitability, or at least guarantees not heavy losses. And, you know, what happened with Man City and UEFA is pretty much the end of financial fair play. And what's that going to mean for football that is desperately in need of fresh capital when it's lost its major selling slide in the pitch deck, i.e. we won't lose a bucket load of money?
Well, Roger, let's explain financial fair play as it pertains to football first, because there will be people out there who aren't necessarily football fans. So why don't you just quickly run through how it works in football, because, you know, it's similar to salary caps and stuff, but Let's get into it.
There's it comes from UEFA. Some leagues have got their own versions of it, and you know that's another discussion. But let's stay on the UEFA one, which basically they say you can't play in our tournaments unless, in very plain man's English, your football club is breaking even over the medium term after we eliminate the cash out that you have for good things like academies, like women's football, like all the things that one could argue are investments for the future. We want to say on a kind of like cash in, cash out basis for ongoing operations, you as a football club are breaking even. If you are not, you will not play in our tournaments and we may ban you from them for a significant amount of time. Man City were banned for 2 years and that was overturned. So you could get into the formula and not get out of it after 3 hours. That's not the point, Grant. It's just simply, are we breaking even as a football club?
Right. And you know, so what's interesting is that obviously the Man City get hauled up before UEFA for breaking these rules. And when you look at some of the clubs and some of the money that's being thrown around, I mean, this isn't a surprise to anybody, right?
No, they're as guilty as hell. Let's be honest here.
No, you know, of course they are.
And Tebes is right, and the Spanish guy, Klopp's right, Mourinho's right. The fact is UEFA have caved, Grant, and that's the real interesting story here, because the story of European football for the last 25 years, when we've seen the changes in the Champions League and the guaranteed four places for the big five leagues, is that whenever the big teams exert a little bit of pressure on the throat of UEFA, the pants come down. And that's what's happened this time.
No, look, undoubtedly. But I thought Jose Mourinho actually was spot on with his press conference. I mean, he called it right. He said, look, you're either innocent or you're guilty. If you reduce the fine and they're still being fined, they're guilty. And he's absolutely right. You either pay nothing or you pay a huge fine. But Rod, just talk about why they capitulate in the face of a Man City. When you talk about that, as soon as there's a little bit of pressure, they cave in. Why does UEFA feel that it needs Man City? There are plenty of other teams, or is this just the thin end of the wedge?
There's two questions there. Why do they cave in general? The answer to that is they're scared of a breakaway league that's financed by either FIFA or private equity or a combination of the two.
Right.
That's easy, right? They today are the regulator of European football. They've got this wonderful privileged monopoly position, and their only threat to that is if the big clubs say, "I can make more money elsewhere." That's why they cave. Man City. This gets into the real difficulty of sports law and sports governance. All sporting rights holders have got their own rule book. And they're mainly mostly private members clubs, which means that if you become a member, you're accepting the rule book, how absurd you may think it is today, tomorrow, or in a distant future. So when UEFA goes into these things and plays the rule book, and then somebody else goes to the legal courts and it comes back the way, It gets very, very messy and full of loopholes, is my point. Man City have driven a horse and cart through UEFA's own protocols, time barred, the kind of ways that you can make an appeal, not make an appeal, who you can make an appeal to. I'd link it then, I'll stop, to a similar thing that's happening in Scotland. Hearts and Partick Thistle have been relegated. The season didn't finish, you'll remember. They took the league, the SPFL, to court. They lost that, and they are now being told that any appeal that needs to go to the SFA. The SFA are saying, well, actually, not only am I not going to grant your appeal, I'm going to really hammer you because you went to the courts outside of the football constitution. So football and sport, anytime you have people threatening to take it to the normal courts, you know it's going to end up the way Man City UEFA ended up. Loads of lawyers, loads of loopholes, and whoever's got the best legal team wins.
And that is the point. Sorry, Grant. That's the point, isn't it, Roger? Is that right now we've been talking for ages about sport needing to as an industry, having to repurpose itself, get its landscape sorted for the future. And financial investment from outside people like Redbird Capital and the other people that we've been talking to, this is where sports lifelines lie, outside of outside of the bubble and in the real world.
Yes.
And the real world needs to know that the regulation and the rules are there to protect investment for their own investment and for growth.
Yes.
And what this has demonstrated is that the bubble of football has still not got itself together, which means that as an investable asset, questions will be asked and people will be taking a view and going, do you know what, for that reason, I'm not certain we can help. And that just potentially brings down the house of cards.
Yeah, I would give you another example that the three of us kind of like commented on about a week ago. All of us saw the horrendous numbers that the Championship EFL clubs have in terms of revenues compared to their wage costs. The numbers are voodoo economics, to quote somebody on a past age. Now, this is the thing that gets me in football, and I'm a football guy, I've worked in football, but I cannot stop my frustration. Football will spend unsustainable amounts of money for a third or fourth striker on the hope that at one point he'll come off the bench and score a goal that maybe does saves them from relegation or something like that. And that's how you get the numbers. They then will not invest what is relatively peanuts. I'm talking chicken feed money on technology that can massively improve the operational model of their club, whether that's recruitment AI, whether it's injury AI, whether it's like pump jack and data stuff. They will scream all day long that they can't afford a 20k a year license fee for that, and they will piss away, sorry, because you have to say these things, piss away amounts of money that are obscene. And you know, so that's the second point of this. Football, and mainly football, but also sport, needs to really change its mindset here. Are we going to do this as professionals, or are we going to play like amateur hour we have done for the last 50 years?
But Roger, this is really interesting, because if you think about any business that deals with customers, right, you'll adjust your products, you'll make decisions on what you think is a good way to spend money, and a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes. But if you're Kellogg's putting cornflakes out on the shelves, you don't have 50,000 people screaming at you every week, right, for the decisions you make. So when you buy these strikers, it's for that exact reason. If you go and spend 20 grand on a piece of data, you don't get any kudos for that. The fans don't understand it. The fans don't. And what they'd see is that, oh, you've let this striker slip through your fingers. I mean, this is, you know, we've seen this at Arsenal off and on for the last decade, right? Screaming about we should be in there buying these expensive players. You know, Wenger ended up being booted out of Arsenal by the fans who once adored him, because it was perceived that he and Kroenke or whoever, Usmanov, weren't spending the money to get the big players. So what do you do when you're in that situation? If you know that the fans are going to vote, be very vocal and stick all kinds of pressure on you if you're not in there buying the big strikers, and if you can save 20 grand here and 50 grand there, I mean, I get it. I think you're right. I think it's ridiculous, but I totally understand.
Well, Grant, you're right. You're right. And that's why every investor or anybody that's looking at a football club, the first question you need to ask the owner, the chairman, the CEO, when the moment gets tough, because it will always get tough, no matter who you are you going to cave to the fans or not? It's the first question in my due diligence list.
Yeah,
are you going to cave to the fans or not? And if they start waffling, you start looking for another club. Coming back to your other point about they don't get it, well, in some clubs, they do get it. If you look at the amount of days that are lost to injury in every club in Europe, and you multiply that by the cost of the players, you're talking about an average loss, I would say, of £4 million a year due to injuries for a Premiership team. If you can spend 25 grand and reduce that by 75%, because that's what Gaddafi's doing. I'm not going to mention the technology, because that's not what I'm here for. But that's what Gaddafi is doing with technology. That's a 3 million saving on four. That's 75%. But you cannot get a club to pay 25K to realise a saving of 3 million. That's how screwed up football is, Grant.
Yeah, well, sadly, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's an awful thing to say, but it's the truth. It doesn't surprise me at all, Roger.
But I think also what's therefore has happened is that we're predicting a fair amount of gloom in the sports industry because of what's been going on, and financially there's going to be some real casualties. And as a result, it's going to be the strongest, those who adapt, those who do exactly the kind of, take the kind of remedial action which starts with running the business properly, have best chance of success. Because to run it like the old boys club network and just to keep spending, hoping that striker might put the ball in the back of the net or kick the goal or whatever it may be, it's going to be too late.
But it seems like all the well-run clubs, Rog, are the Brentfords of the world, right? Yeah, there's a well-run football
You've
team.
You've hit the nail on the head. Brentford, yeah, Atalanta.
Yeah.
And the secret is always the same. It's a long-term vision about the kind of club you want to be. You put in the data and the infrastructure and the tech to give you the edge because you can't throw money at the problem. And you've got an owner who, come what may, will stick to the plan and not cave when, you know, you had a couple of bad months. Always, always the same characteristics, but it is pretty rare. My hope is that people see Brentford, they see Atalanta, they see Gaddafi, and they say, look, this can be done, and not only can we compete at the highest level, Gaddafi and Atalanta are still in Europe at these late stages, but we can make a lot of money. Anybody looking at the profits that Atalanta's thrown off the last 5 years, you'll be like, you know, it's like huge amounts of money, huge amounts.
But Rush, this brings us back to that same point, right? Because this is not new science. The technology's new, but I mean, Billy Beane was doing this in baseball, what, 20 years ago, right? And there cannot be a sports executive who hasn't read Moneyball or watched the movie if they're lazy, right? This is not complicated, but it just shows you how much an influence the fans and giving the fans what they want sways these guys. I mean, forget the fans. They want to be the owner of a successful club, and they want to be the guy in the papers signing the $100 million strike. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Well, in the same way, take it from something else. You don't ask the beer drinker to run the brewery.
Right. Yes.
Good right. Point. You just serve the beer. And you let the business get on with the business. It's a crude example, but if what COVID to me has been so fascinating is that sport went away for 2 months and we all wailed and gnashed our teeth and tore our hair out because guess what? The fan missed it. And that is the good news for the sports industry. People love sport and people want sport and people want to be entertained. Therefore, that's really good news for investors because it means that there is a product and therefore there is a long-term rosy future for the sports industry. But now is the moment where there will be a downturn because of probably a global recession, which means that the haves and the have-nots, and there will be those that fall by the wayside. Now is the opportunity to build those businesses properly. And yes, respect the fans, love the fans, do things for the fans, but understand the business needs to run as a business so the fans get what they want, which is a diet of sport.
Yeah, Giles, that's true. But we all of us are, I wouldn't say guilty because that's too strong a word. All of us do what we did on the podcast with Jerry, that when we switch that romantic switch and we say the phrases that I said, that Jerry said, we don't really own the club, we're just custodians because the fans own the club. You know, once you admit that, then you're obliged to listen to them when times get tough. But as you say about the brewery and the alcoholic, it's the wrong business decision because they are not rational. That is the hard thing about making money in sport. You want to give the fans their place. You want to make recognition of the fact that without them, there is nothing. But woe betide you if you start listening to them to dictate how you run the club.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Roger. And I think that lack of rationality is known by everybody, even the fans, right? I mean, that's the bizarre thing. Even the fans will admit to being completely irrational about it, but it doesn't change the desired outcome, and it doesn't change the extent to which they want these expensive players, and they want the club to just do whatever it takes to win and screw the finances. No one cares about that.
Yep.
Well, so let's move on to Ferrari, Rog, because it's a similar story. Let's walk through that one.
Yeah, and this one I'll ask Giles to help me a little bit in Formula One. He's becoming quite an expert in that these days. But basically, you know, a couple of things we need to look at about Formula One in this period they've come back. There's, as I say, this story about Ferrari that I think people that haven't lived in Italy or haven't had exposure to Formula One don't realise the importance of Ferrari. It's not like any other team. Our wonderful friend of the podcast, Murray Barnett, said to me the other day, said, you know, they're different from everybody else. They make cars, they manufacture cars so they can race. Everybody else races so they can manufacture and sell cars. It's completely different. Now, I grew up when Ferrari with Schumacher had the dominance that Mercedes had now, and it seemed the natural order of things. The biggest brand had the biggest success. It's now best part of a decade where Ferrari have screwed up in many, many ways. And you can always say, well, you know, Hamilton's great and Mercedes are great. We lost to a great rival. You can't say that this season. They are fucking awful. The car is a shambles. The drivers are driving into each other. The head guy, Binotto, he doesn't have the physique at all. He just doesn't look the leader, you know. When you think there's somebody like Ross Brawn sitting at Liberty that, you know, was the architect of the Schumacher years. There's Ferrari cannot continue. I don't think the next time we do this podcast, the groundsman, that he will still be there. Binotto, Vettel's leaving. They've got signs coming in. You know, all of Formula One's getting younger. That's a great thing. Lando Norris is great. But in general, the sport has got a couple of issues, a couple short-term and a couple medium-term. Short-term, I can see no way they're going to get any races away in the Americas. All the Grand Prix that are planned there with the virus, I don't see them happening. So there's going to be a big hole there in the short-term. In the medium-term, they have got the dominance of Mercedes that isn't good. It just is not a good thing. And you know, that's a problem. But the good news that the virus has brought is that it has imposed a budget cap on the teams, much stricter than even Liberty had hoped for, because they just doesn't have any money. So we may be getting to the stage where the teams competing in Formula One, like the conversation we just had in football with financial fair play, are set out to be profitable. And when that happens, watch the investment come in.
Roger, let me ask you something, because when we look at the Netflix show, Drive to Survive, which both seasons is fantastic, really, really enjoyed them.
Yep.
And on the one hand, they, I'm sure, have done wonders for engagement levels with Formula One. I know for me, it's hugely increased my enjoyment of it and my inclination to watch it, knowing more about the characters. But surely there is, as it turns out now, a downside to that, because before this, we would have had no idea what goes on behind the scenes at Ferrari. And yet now, having taken us and given us the ability to be those flies on the wall, we now get to see all this. And for the guys in charge, there's nowhere to hide anymore. And you know, incompetence that could have been passed off as poor luck or whatever, we can see all that now. And so I don't know whether those fly-on-the-wall documentaries suddenly become things that people don't want to be involved in, because when you can see how the sausage is made, and the Williams episode was the perfect example of that.
Perfect example.
Yeah, I wonder whether, again, right, you've got this opposition between the interests of the fan and the interests of the people running the business. The fans love being taken behind the scenes, but once you get taken behind the scenes, you expose the management of these things for what most managements are, right? And that's incompetent.
Well, I would start with the first bit that you said. I think Drive to Survive has been wonderful for Formula One in general, and the profile of the Sainz kind of drivers and the ones that all the young ones that are coming up now. So I think they've done a great job. The Williams episode, and I'd love to hear Giles's view on this now, showed you, I think, some of the problems that are there. But listen, you mentioned Ferrari. First of all, Ferrari didn't really appear a lot on Drive to Survive.
No.
But secondly, without Drive to Survive, let me tell you that in Italy, everybody knows what's going on in that paddock. You know, like old school sports reporting.
Sure.
You know, listen, they're basically saying, you don't do it in Hungary, Binotto, don't come into work on Monday. You know, we know that. We don't need Drive to Survive for that. But, you know, Giles is now like right in the middle of all this. And you know, it'd be lovely to hear his view about how he sees Formula One as a... I think these guys are very professional, but, you know, let's hear what the captain thinks.
Well, I take a slightly different view from what you were saying, Grant, and I hear it, obviously, you know, too much fly on the wall can give you the real story, and sometimes that can be dangerous. But what sells sport, any sport, but particularly Formula One because of the sheer global scale, is the humanity behind it. You think of the legend that was Senna. That isn't just about the guy driving the car. It's about the charisma. It's about the rivalry with Prost, etc. And I think what Drive to Survive did is reminded everybody of the sheer humanity of this vast circus. And to be human is to err. And I think that isn't necessarily a bad thing, even though people think they demand. And therefore, for me, it added colour. And for a team like Williams, who I've been lucky enough to get a little bit closer to recently, is that they haven't been as successful as the glory is. They know that, but they have a wonderful brand based out of history, which is often in sports teams and clubs where brand comes from. It's the history, it's glory years, it's nearly there, it's the triumph, it's all of those human stories. And that is actually the value of Formula One going forward, which is why, for me, series like that are really important, because it makes it beyond the racing into something far more powerful, which is actually where the whole value of sport. I bang on all the time about the fan being the most important ingredient, the most important constituent, the individual fan. And the fan's passion comes from humanity. And Formula One, being such a high-tech sport, has to be high tech. It has to be that. When you then have the opportunity to platforms which brings it down to reality or the real world that we all understand, I think the value is absolutely exponential.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, we say at the start of this, and Giles, you said this, right? The heart, the fan, and that, I think what Roger talked about when we were talking about the financial fair play is right. This struggle between complete irrationality and the need to run a business, this struggle between the traditions of clubs and sports going back, you know, a century or more versus the increasing influence of technology. I mean, there is always this conflict in sport.
And Jerry Cardinale said it on our last show. If you think investing in sport is easy, you've got another thing's coming. The balance is so fine, to exactly what we're talking about, between the need to keep the fan happy and passionate, because that's your lifeblood, versus the need to run the business sensibly and logically, because otherwise you have no business. And it's on the finest of lines, the pendulum, at any one time, and which is what makes it even more exciting as an industry to be in, because, you know, you take the Formula One example on one hand, where there's an enforced sense of rules and regulation, versus what's happened in UEFA, where we're now kind of mocking it somewhat. And somewhere in the middle lies the truth and what needs to happen. But I'm not sure one will ever get the center line, because you're always teetering on one side or the other.
That's very well put.
Roger, let me ask you this, because I think you, like me, are a great believer that you invest in people first, right? You always have the right people in place,
always.
Right? So let's talk about that with relation to sport, because in business, you're going to invest in the people, and that's fine. Now, in in football, for example, let's use that as the example. You have a very high profile person in the manager, and generally speaking, with the odd exceptions of the Fergusons of the world, these guys come in for a very short term. I mean, we spoke about this, whether it's going to be normal for guys, even successful managers, to come and do 2 or 3 years in a place, 3 or 4 years maybe, and then move on. So if you're investing in the people, who are you investing in a football team, for example? If you come in to buy, Man United, who are the people you're investing in? Because it's such a transitory business.
Great question. Let me comment this a little bit round the houses. In the old days of the 60s and everything like that, the great clubs were built by these managers, Matt Busby, yeah. Bill Shankly, Jock Stein, Brian Clough. We did that. That was the job of a chairman, the owner of a club, was just to identify this right person and basically just say, there's the keys of the stadium, I'll see you at the game. And they did nothing else. Sadly, we've moved all the way to the other end of it. Why do I say sadly? Because these are great characters and they were able to build what is called in American sport dynasties. When things like the Bosman rule happened, which meant the fact that they had players under their command, basically, it was modern slavery, if you will. There was no freedom of contract. They were able to do that. As soon as football became a short-term game of short-term contracts and management of transfer fees and every year left on the contract, it's got huge amortization, you need a different skill set of person. And here's the issue with football, the way I see it. There's a lot of football that still thinks that, well, we are the successors of Clough and Shankly, so give us all the power and we understand football and you don't. And there's a lot of people that still think like that in football. And most of those clubs are basket cases. Where you get some exceptions to that are people like Klopp, who through their force of personality can still turn around a club. But there you would say, yes, and this comes back to The Last Dance. Remember the argument you gave me about the coach and the players against the team, you know, and the general manager and his role. The Liverpool team is a great team. They've got a huge amount of data. They've got a huge amount of processes. And Klopp is the kind of like charismatic cherry on the cake. So what I'm saying, Grant, is that today, I think you need to look at the team structure first. And conversely, if you find a team where they have delegated everything to one manager, no matter how good they may appear to be in that particular moment in time, you're going to end up badly. It is the structure of the club or the franchise that where you need to be investing now. And that's what sport, I don't think, has got its head round. When you get Klopp, it throws all the plaudits to, oh, the modern Bob Paisley, the modern Bill Shankly. Maybe. He's got immense skills, both on the field and in terms of EQ and man management. But Liverpool is so much better as a club than Man United. You know, Man United have very little structure and processes between Ed Woodward and whoever they've got in the manager in that particular week or month or whatever, because they change it pretty regularly, it seems.
Yeah.
The difference is that that's what you're investing in. Tell me what you're set out to do. Tell me the tech and the processes, the data that you use to reach your objective, and tell me that you've got a process for assuming that the manager, or I prefer to call it the head coach, can be substituted every 5 years and your club doesn't miss a beat.
Yeah. And again, that brings us back to fans and perhaps Giles, you can weigh on this, sponsors, right? Because the Mourinho is the perfect example of this, right? Everywhere he's gone, he's been loved and eventually hated. And it seems that the period between the two extremes is getting shorter with each club. But it's the perfect example. So how do you, if you're running this club and you have to answer to the fans and more you have to answer to the sponsors, how do you balance that? Because it seems an impossibility for me.
Well, I think it's what you both said earlier, is you invest in people. And I think that the well-run clubs with really strong management executive teams become very investable because of the rest of the business that follows. And where you get, it's like any business. You're looking for who's steering the ship, who's got the vision. And to Roger's point, the really boring things like data analytics for fans or on field, it's really boring. And fans shouldn't really know or care, in the same way who your catering supplier for the stadium is not of great interest to the fan. But these are the good business practices that creates a business behind it. The on-field is, of course, the unknown. But I think I was talking to someone earlier the other day, is that the great businesses of sport is that fans, of course, they want success, but true fans also forgive defeat. They just want to see success. Is that fans are very loyal. They're far more loyal than they are in any other business. So what they want to see is a well-run business where then the right attitude is taken to what happens on the field or on the track. And for me, this is such a this whole pandemic has been such a moment where these businesses of sport look at themselves to get themselves fit for purpose for a modern era. And we'll see whether that happens.
But let me ask you this then. How many good executive teams are there, really, realistically speaking, Rog? Because we've been taken behind the scenes of Sunderland, right? We've seen two owners in two series, both of whom looked hopelessly out of their depth. Neither of whom seemed to have an impressive group of people around them. And, you know, ultimately, I agree with you, Giles, and the thing that struck me about the Sunderland series in particular, at the end of season one, the gloom and the despair about the relegation and this is the end of the world, and then fast forward to the beginning of season two, here we go again, we can't wait for the season to start. So you're right, you do have this fan base that are utterly loyal. And yes, they'll get on your case, and yes, they'll get on your back, and they'll complain and bitch and moan, and they want the striker out and the manager out and the board out and everybody else out. But you know they're coming back next season. So why is it that there are so few management teams, it seems, in place who can look past that?
Well, the first thing is about silos. You know, one of the biggest problems for most football clubs is that the football department is completely detached from everybody else, so there's no commonality of purpose, and they use that almost as a badge of honor. You know, like I've had many examples of, you know, people trying to like breach the inner sanctum of the football department, and it's a big department. You know, there's the coaches, the masseurs, the kit guys. You know, they all kind of hang out together. You saw that in the Man City thing as well. You know, when a commercial or marketing guy comes in, or even data guys. You know, they're sneering under their glances, you know, and you know they'll make the nice noises while they're there, and then when they leave, they'll all have a laugh as if it's like a classroom of 15-year-olds. You know, there is a lot of us and them, and the first thing you have to look at is how much is this particular club or franchise in sync with rowing in the same direction. To think back to Jerry. All making the same splash in the water, and you will find that I think it's 1 in 10 are just on that basis there. They are not set up to be rowing in the same direction. Mistrust, misaligned objectives. The managers are looking very much at a short-term time frame. 4 games, that's a month, 2 months, 3 months, 1 season maximum. And as we've said, to do sport properly, as Jerry said, you need to be in it for a 5-year time frame, and you need to be working on processes of data that can sustain the ups and downs of sporting performance. So that's your answer. There are good people in clubs that are doing very badly, good marketing guys, good commercial guys, it's just that the club is not set up right. It's not able to be rowing in the same direction.
Interesting. All right. Well, what else do you have on deck, Rog? What else do we need to
Well, listen, whilst I light up a wee fag here, I've got one for you, Grant. And I want you to like blow off some steam on this one. You know that we've talked a lot about new finance coming into to sport, and a lot of it is structured in the private equity way. And private equity way means a lot of debt. So a lot of big clubs, and I mean the big clubs, are carrying a huge amount of debt that is securitized against things like future broadcasting and things like that. That's happened consistently in the last 10 years. Now, once you've got debt, all debt has got a rating, hasn't it, Grant?
Yeah.
And the rating is done by the credit agencies.
God bless them.
The credit agencies are paid by the people they're meant to be rating. Am I wrong?
Correct.
Right. Now, that's one of these classic conflicts of interest we've just talked about. But this is on the balance sheet side. So Inter Milan, who are one of these ones with a significant amount of debt, are currently, I think, BBB rated, and they were downgraded by Standard & Poor's to less than that, I think, BBB minus. I think we're pretty close to junk at that point, are we not, Grant?
Indeed.
Right, so guess what Inter Milan did?
Go on.
Changed the rating agency. On you go, I'm having a fag. Knock yourself out.
I do the same when I'm looking at the weather forecast. If I get a weather forecast I don't like on my app, I just go to another app and I get sunshine.
Perfect.
Well, look, I mean, Rog, it's interesting, right? It's the same circus, different town. Look, there are several rating agencies. I mean, the big ones, obviously, Standard & Poor's, Moody's and Fitch. But there are also like second tier, that there's even Chinese rating agencies. So you can kind of move yourself along that curve until you find a rating you like. And I think with central banks buying up bonds of companies,
who cares?
It's more interesting than ever, perhaps, right? When you look at the fact that because you're trying to use a carving knife to perform microsurgery, as the central banks are, you have found the Fed buying Amazon bonds and Apple bonds. I mean, you know, Apple have more cash on their balance sheets than half the countries in the world, right? And yet the Fed are stepping in to support their bonds simply because they're in a certain index and that's how it works. So, you know, you talk about not understanding how things are done, understanding how things are run. The average fan has no clue how the financial side of this works, has no clue what it means for Inter Milan to change the ratings agency, has no clue at all. So it I would argue that it really doesn't matter, because the only people that are really going to understand what it means are the people who are actually going to put money into these things. They understand exactly how this thing works. And there's a huge amount of don't ask, don't tell. There's a huge amount of, as long as you can give me an investment grade rating, I don't care where it comes from. As long as there is an investment grade rating from somebody, I can own your bonds. It's as simple as that. And if you don't have that rating, I can't own them. It's in my covenants. I cannot own speculative grade paper. So it's that simple, Rog. I mean, it's the way the financial markets have been corrupted over the years, bleeds through into sport, and they play by those rules at that level. The rules of the game itself are one thing, the rules of the financial world are another, and you just need to stick to them.
Yeah, like you say, I don't think many people bother, although, you know, they should, because if we just take two North London clubs and look at their interest cost for servicing the debts they have. I may be wrong here, but I think Tottenham Hotspur are currently paying 2%, whereas the Gunners are playing 7%. You know, on the level of debts they have, that's a significant amount of new players each year and interest expenses. You know, so fans should think about this, but they don't. But, you know, I thought you would like that wee story.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. It just speaks to the kind of game within the game, right? And that's always the thing that you never really get a look at.
I've got one for you, Giles. Now, you had Mark Pugash on the captain's table. This week, we saw, in my opinion, not his greatest moment video of a little bit of whinging from...
I'm with you with this, Rog.
Clive Tilsdale, if that his name. Is that his name, yeah?
Tilsley, yeah.
Tilsley, sorry, I don't see a lot of him because I'm in Italy. Great commentator, fantastic commentator, getting on a little bit, and came out with a video basically saying, I've been sacked, I don't understand why. Whereas the obvious answer is to say, how many of the younger kids actually appreciate my way of commentating? How many of them identify with somebody of my age? So Giles, what I'm asking you is, Pugash, Test Match Special, Clive here, are we ever going to find the balance between these new young audiences and the kind of like commentary they want and the old sport doyens that made our younger lives so beautiful? Where's the balance, Giles?
Well, I didn't think Clive's Twitter video was very sensible, and I think we're all agreeing with that. It just looked a bit like, you know, people lose jobs. It happens. Get over it. Suck it up, buttercup, I'm afraid. I do think the broadcasters are, particularly the BBC, which doesn't refer to this, but the BBC in particular, are going after a very aggressively after a new audience, and perhaps in some ways the pendulum's going too far, because there are still many people over the age of 40 who love watching sport and like, or whatever it may be, or drama, or, you know, natural history, or whatever it be. You know, Pugach got flung out because he was considered too old at the ripe old age of 51. I think the broadcasters need to be using their technology better. Guess what? Because you can have many different styles of commentary. You've got one picture, but you can have a whole lot of different
streams. Yep.
Different streams that says, right, this is going to be maybe more of a someone who's more dynamic and young, and someone who, some people hate Peter Alice's golf commentaries, other people love it. It doesn't really matter. It's, for me, the streams that change. I think it's very interesting, the kind of whinging on Twitter, I don't think is a smart move. I think the broadcasters are climbing over themselves to be down with the kids when I'm not sure the kids are even watching the long form anyway. So why would you throw the baby out with the bathwater? You could argue. But somewhere in the middle lies sense, which is, well, why don't we have different streams, different audiences, that then everybody is happy?
Yeah. Rog, I've got to say, well, I read the headline first that Tilsley was out, and I thought, oh, that's a shame, you know, because he is a very good commentator. I guess he's a very good commentator for someone of my age. I mean, I will absolutely agree with you that maybe it's not what the kids want to listen to. But then I saw that video, and I was just shaking my head going, what are you doing? This is just desperate. And then to see the next day the story come out, obviously carefully leaked, that he was actually told in 2018 that he wasn't going to be renewed, just made it that much worse. So I think he's done himself no favors at all with that video.
Yeah, but in the theme in general, you know, and this comes always to your point, Grant, about chasing audiences that are transient. There's been a whole lot of what I would call cool strategic thinking around content that has been proven to be pretty shallow beyond the narrative. You know, Otro, Dugout have not been the successes that they should have been given the names associated with them. This week we saw Kevin Durant and his boardroom series of The Business of Sport get cancelled because it wasn't working. You know, so I think, you know, we're going to get into a stage now where people are going to say, yeah, young, old, female, male, whatever. It's either good or it's rubbish, you know? And I think that's the phase we're going to go into now. We had an explosion of sports content and everybody doing it. Same in Netflix as well. You know, you see what happened to the subscriber numbers. Maybe they've peaked as well. I think we're in a moment of rationalization of content.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree, and it's ironic that you're bringing the competitive nature of sport, which is as it should be, into that side of things, which I think can only be a good thing. I mean, ultimately, the best, and by best, you're obviously talking about engagement with the audience, is going to win, which is, I guess, the way it should be.
What do you think, Giles?
It's for me, it's really interesting. It's again, technology is moving everything, changing everything. We've got different audiences, different consumption, different channels. And what we're seeing is a kind of rationalization, which we're living through the middle of, which is long form, short form content. Well, how do the kids watch sport? They still love sport, just different ways. So that's going to evolve and change. But then they grow up and then they may want to go back to a more of a long form, or maybe they don't. We're living through such fast evolution that technology and therefore broadcasts and or pitches are going to evolve and change. I think that sometimes the broadcasters are being too rapid by chucking out the old guard, which serves many, many people. At the same time, I think that they have to adapt for the new audiences. And in a sense, we're in a trial. We're in a trial period because technology exploded around about the 1950s when TV was kind of invented and became more mainstream and then became the norm in the 60s and particularly the 70s and the 80s. And then we've seen the next phase, which is a different type of technology, which is completely disrupting consumption of everything within sport. And we're living through the middle of it. So the Tilsley story is, on one hand, it's an interesting insight of maybe how not to react on social media, which you wouldn't have known about 30 years ago because it hadn't been invented. Also, it's significant because it shows the broadcasters and what they're trying to do, but you might argue they're knee-jerking. And somewhere in the middle, sense will prevail based on, as always, trial and error.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because we're coming up on the hour, this may be a rather big question, but winners and losers of this, because the only sport that I've really seen since the resumption that feels normal and feels like I have the same amount of engagement in, for me, has been Formula One. And I think that's because the crowd doesn't really matter so much in the Formula One, because obviously they're going around the track. You're not really seeing the crowd. You don't feel the crowd. You can't hear the crowd over the noises. But, you know, I've watched the football and it's just been really flat without the crowd. I've watched the golf, the same thing, really flat without the crowd. And I do wonder, I mean, what's your take, gents, in terms of that? Because I've just been way less engaged in this.
Well, let me go first. Roger will always have a view. I think it's really interesting, and it comes back to a technology partner of ours, Smart Sports, that we've spoken about in the past. I think what has been undervalued in the big mass sports like football in particular, but also cricket that's made a resumption over here in England the last week or so. And without a crowd, it is not the same product. It just isn't. The crowd is a vital ingredient in the commercial value, if that's the right word, of the consumption and the joy of sport, the adulation of the fan, the noise, the chanting, whatever it may be. So on that level, the sooner we can get back to some sort of normalcy, the better. And I think lots of people would agree with that. There are other sports, and Formula One is one. Of course, they had packed stands, but they didn't really change what happened in the arc of the camera because everything's going too fast. But there are a heap of other sports which, you know, maybe one man and his dog might turn up to, and that the crowd has not got much of a role. And those sports, I think, can really start thinking about technology to superimpose some form of background backdrop, if you like, that is not required on a fan base that doesn't spend the money and isn't really there and doesn't contribute much to the coffers. So for me, it's been really interesting. The big sports require big fans, and sport has been the less for it because of that. But I think for other sports that never really attracted necessarily big live audiences, but maybe had, when I say live audiences, I mean in place, in situ, but may have a real value as a TV opportunity, as entertainment, I think there is a massive opportunity for smart thinking sports to think about life with artificial crowds and or backdrops. I think that's really interesting.
Well, actually, I've got nothing to add to that. That's exactly what I was going to say. Perfect.
Well, I think you touched on someone there, Charles, that perhaps there is a chance for one man and his dog to come back. I mean, there's something that doesn't need audience participation, and what a cracking sport that is.
It was certainly a favourite of my grandfather living in Brecon in mid-Wales. He loved that show. It was his Friday night sort of get-on show.
no doubt tuning in to see if there were any attractive sheep.
Absolutely right.
Well, one thing, Grant, just before we close very, very quickly. You know, we all do, Giles and I, we do a lot of work on startups and speaking at startup conferences and things like that. And we all pontificate about what we need to look to see and who do we invest in, and it's the people, and does the company have a moat? We've done a lot of these things recently. And then you see something and you think, really? You know, like, it's all bullshit. You know, Gymshark? I mean, are you aware of Gymshark, Grant?
No.
It's a sports apparel brand aimed
at... Oh, yes, a big part. I'm vaguely familiar with it. I've come across it, but I don't know anything about
it. Right, now probably going to be valued about $1 billion.
Yeah, that's why I saw it.
Yeah, so, you know, I was just thinking, you get this guy, a young guy, I think he was a teenager at the time, coming to you saying, I'm going to take on Nike and Adidas in a very regulated industry where distribution contacts are key, and you need to spend a lot on marketing, otherwise you're not going to get anywhere. And I want you to give me money as a seed founder because I'm going to be a $1 billion company. You would just laugh him out the room. And here we are, this chap, Gymshark. It's a lesson for us all. Never have too much hubris.
Well, how's he done it, Rog?
Cool factor, aiming at a younger audience. It's literally, you know, it's word of mouth, viral, cool factor. Don't wear any of the old. I don't know, but that's what my kids told me. I had a private equity guy come to me and say, look, I'm interested in buying rundown brands in the UK or in Europe, investing in them and building up again in Europe, but more importantly, taking them back to China. And
send him to Fulham, would you?
And I said, I said to my kids, well, all the obvious ones, you know, Diadora, Lotto, the one, you know, Sergio Tacchini, the ones that were really around at the time of the 70s and 80s. And they said, No, Gymshark. And I said, I've not heard of that. And they told me, they said, it's cool. That was it. It's cool. $1 billion company.
Well, look, we'll see, Rog. These are precisely the things that
you don't like
about.
This stuff.
No, look, but only because by its very definition, right, if it's cool, then I guarantee you there will be a time when it won't be cool. And this has always been the problem, right? These things are cyclical, and when they're cool, it's great. But the cycle from cool to naff is becoming way, way shorter than it used to be, because there are so many other ways for new companies to get eyeballs and get in front of people and become cool. So, you know, I don't know. Let's see about Gymshark. But when I hear it described as cool, then cool is a trend. Cool is a fashion. Cool is a moment in time.
But Grant, you're correct in everything there. But we are being proven wrong day by day. You know, if you look at the fashion and makeup accessories of the Kanye West Kardashian clan, these are huge numbers that are based around very simple influencer marketing techniques, which is all at the end of the day, somebody I like thinks it's cool, so I'm going to have it as well. You know, that's the new world we're in. And I think it's we need to we underestimate that at our peril. The influencer thing for this generation is a big one.
But by its very definition, you can't keep adding influencers, which is what we're doing, and without subtracting some, because there's an amount of spend here, right? So by its very definition, everybody can't be cool continuously. You can't just, oh, here's another cool guy, another cool, and the other guys are still cool. It doesn't work that way. So Gymshark is cool now, but you know, when Gym Rat comes along, and that's cooler than Gymshark, because you know, Facebook was cool, and then suddenly everyone had Facebook, and everyone was, and so it became Snapchat, and then Instagram. It just doesn't work that way. So, you know, I look at these $1 billion valuations for what will very likely, I won't say definitely, but very likely turn out to be a fad and a moment in time. Look at Crocs, right? How cool were Crocs? You know, I don't know. I just don't think that whole cool thing has any kind of shelf life. And make hay while that sun is shining. And if you're an insider in the company and you can get any way to sell your shares while it's worth $1 billion, I would do it as quick as you can.
Well, I've got a cool brand for you. My Mountfield heavy roller, which I need to get back on.
Yeah, and start we need to get back to work.
I need to get the cricket square. Over. Absolutely. Lunch is over, boys. And I've got a Mountfield. That's a brand for all seasons. I thank you.
Well, and Roger needs to get back to his fag. So we should probably wrap this up. As always, gentlemen, it's been fun taking a break with you both. Thank you all for listening to us nattering away while leaning on our rakes. To remind you, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast in iTunes. It really, really does help us, and we would be enormously appreciative. Follow us on Twitter at entertainedare. That's the word A-R-E. You can follow me on Twitter at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
And you can follow me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, back to work it is. Yeah. Let's chat soon.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.